This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Hi everyone, this is Chris Grasso with the Indie Spirituals Podcast on the Be Here Now Network, and my guest today is the wonderful writer, Phil Goldberg. Phil, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Chris.
So before we get started, as I always do, I'd like to read your bio for my audience just to give them a little background, and then we're going to dig even deeper into your background and then talk about some of the very, very incredible work that you have done and continue to do. So that being said, Philip Goldberg is an acclaimed author and public speaker whose numerous books include the award-winning American Veda, From Emerson and the Beatles to Yoga and Meditation, How Indian Spirituality Changed the West, Road Signs on the Spiritual Path, Living at the Heart of the Paradox, and his new book, a comprehensive biography of Paramahansa Yogananda, titled The Life of Yogananda, The Story of the Yogi Who Became the First Modern Guru. A meditation teacher and ordained interfaith minister, he is also the co-host of the popular Spirit Matters podcast and leads American Veda tours to India. His website is www.philip.goldberg.com. I'll just spell that out. philipgoldberg.com. And for those that are listening to this at the Be Here Now Network website, just scroll down and you'll see a link attached so you can click on that. So, Phil, thank you again so much for joining me today. It's a real pleasure to connect. It was a pleasure chatting with you on your podcast not too long ago.
So we're switching roles.
Yeah, it's a joy to have you on mine. So thanks for coming aboard.
It's fun. Thanks.
Yeah. So, I first learned about you through our mutual friend, the wonderful, just beautiful human being, Dana Sawyer, who was, I believe, professor of religions at Mecca College in Portland, Maine. So I was staying with him. I think he and I connected. He had saw an interview I had done. I was on Buddha at the Gas Pump, and he just reached out because he wanted me to come speak to his students, and we hit it off. And my first time visiting him, your name came up, and he had an extra copy of American Veda, and he gave me that, and I absolutely loved it. So it's great how this things just, tend to come full circle.
Yeah. We have a lot of mutual friends.
Yes.
Dana being one of them, and he and I are looking forward to coming east and teaching at Kripalu with him in June.
Yes, right. We talked about that on your show, yeah. and I think that's wonderful. But right when, I'm looking through the endorsements of your newest book, The Life of Yogananda, and absolutely, seeing Ken Wilber and Krishna Das, Michael Bernard Beckwith, the wonderful Andrew Harvey, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, whom I adore, Mirabai Starr and Sally Kempton. I mean, yes, we have many, many lovely, Danny Goldberg, who also hosts a show here on the Be Here Now Network. I mean, just a laundry list of truly beautiful people that that we're interconnected through. So it's been great getting to know you a bit better. And And so speaking of which, before we get to this new book, which I'm excited to talk to you about, The Life of Yogananda, I wanted to talk to you about Phil. You know, so if you don't mind, Phil, maybe sharing a little bit about going back as far as, you know, I leave it to you, but as far back as you'd like, maybe what ended up leading you to the spiritual path. I know you and I share very similar viewpoints and appreciations for interspirituality and drawing, you know, inspiration from all of the great wisdom traditions and their mystic elements. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that and what led you to the path first and foremost.
Well, essentially, I was a child of the 60s.
Sure.
So like some of the people you mentioned in going through the endorsers to my book, and like one of them, Danny Goldberg, chronicled in his book about 1967. And like Ram Dass, only, you know, half a generation younger, I grew up in an era where, you know, question authority was the bumper sticker. And in fact, I was raised that way. I grew up in Brooklyn. My parents were secular Jews. Mm-hmm. And to say they were non-religious is really an understatement. They were anti-religious.
Sure.
And so I had no religious upbringing at all, except to think that people who were religious were fools.
Yeah, you and I sure
that's how. Yeah. And you know, they were lefties, so religion was the opium of the people. And that's how I was right into college. And I was a social activist. I would, you know, march for civil rights and against the war. And I did everything I could to avoid the draft back then in the Vietnam days. But that the spirit of that era was not just of protest and anti-authority sort of activism, but also of deep questioning. For many of us, anyway, you know, there was at the same time we were socially involved, we were questioning what's real and what's not real, what's true and what's not true, what's a path of authentic living and what is artificial, and what are we here for? Who are we? What is this all about? And we were exploring and we were looking for answers, and part of that was psychedelics and drug use. And, you know, say what you will about the indiscriminate use of them, as many of us did back then, there were dangers and hazards. But for many of us, it was a door opener. It was like we had a glimpse of something beyond ordinary reality and a glimpse of transcendence. And so part of the search was exposure to the ideas and practices that came to us from the East. So what ordinary people would call Hinduism and Buddhism were coming our way in mostly in books in those days,
right?
Pre-internet and pre-social media and everything. So books were being passed around and borrowed and stolen. And then gurus started to come, you know, some of the, you know, teachers from India, there were Buddhist teachers, Zen teachers mainly.
Yeah.
And then some of the swamis and guru yogis that were coming. And so there was something about the exposure to Eastern philosophy through people like, in my case, Alan Watts.
Yeah.
And Aldous Huxley,
yep.
And then directly, you know, I remember getting my first copy of the Bhagavad Gita. I was living in New York, and it was hard to find one. And how did I know about it? Because I was reading Thoreau, and Thoreau mentions it in Walden. So I said, okay, if Thoreau likes it so much, I'll find this thing. And so all of this somehow resonated with me, and I was drawn to learn more and more and more, to go deeper and deeper into it, because even though I had this anti-religious upbringing and sensibility, there was something beyond religion in Eastern practices and Eastern ideas. It was not dogma. It was not doctrine. And it wasn't even speculative philosophy like we think of philosophy. It had the ring of empiricism and rationality. I remember reading something about comparative mysticism. I think it was Evelyn Underwood's book on mysticism, sitting around with my roommates. And I suddenly said, I'm reading this book on mysticism. It doesn't seem very mysterious to me. It seems rational. it seems logical. This appeals to how the world probably works. And what I liked most was nobody asked me to believe in something that was hard to believe.
Sure.
No one said, you must embrace this mythological history or you'll, go to hell or whatever. Yeah. Or you must believe in this creed or this doctrine. They said, these are insights that particularly brilliant and intuitive people, call them sages, rishis, saints, whatever, had, and see if they hold up.
Yeah.
See if they hold up to reason. See if they hold up to empirical evidence. It was never anti-science. It was never anti-history. It was never anti-logic or rationality. Where there were leaps you had to make, they didn't ask you to do it on faith. They said, try it out.
Right.
Try out these methods, and if they work, you'll... fine. And no one asked you to convert or anything. And so I said, well, obviously there's more to the universe than I was learning about I was a psychology major and then a psychology graduate student.
Mm.
Sort of similar to Ram Dass in my own way. I was like, studying psychology, and I never became a psychologist like he did. But, all these openings led to something bigger than what was then known.
Right.
And so I was drawn to it. And by 1968, 50 years ago, Chris, Jesus, sort of in the aftermath of the Beatles going to India to meditate with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, making him the most famous guru on the planet in those days.
Right.
I was drawn to methods, and I practiced Zen meditation. I tried others. So I tried TM, Transcendental Meditation, in 68, and it took on me. It resonated well with me, and it was transformative.
Hmm.
It had immediate effects as soon as I introduced that practice into my life on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And, bodily changes, mental changes. And so I was drawn in that direction, and a couple of years later became a teacher trained by Maharishi. And for several years taught meditation, taught in that context. Deepened my understanding of these, traditional Eastern pathways.
Right.
And then, continued to grow and learn and evolve and branch out and become more eclectic in my spiritual pursuits. And that's been, my life, essentially very consciously doing what I think most of your listeners, if not all of them, have been trying to do, which is to integrate the spiritual growth with worldly responsibilities and pleasures and pains and everything else, which is sort of the ongoing effort that we all make. And every once in a while over the course of my writing career, I got to write about that. And so, that's what I did. And there's a natural segue to the new book, but I'll let you make it whenever you're ready.
Well, yeah, we will jump into that. I just did want to comment. I found it really interesting that, first of all, while my parents weren't religious, they weren't to the extreme that yours were. But I certainly, I was not brought up religious. I appreciate the comment, you know, the opiate of the masses, because that was very much the way I was looking at it. I also did not know the difference between religion and spirituality. To me, they were the same thing. I was very naive. And so I grew up extremely, I don't even know if atheist does justice to my disdain towards religion. You know what I mean?
Me too.
Yeah, I've shared this story before, but I remember when I was a senior in high school, we went up to our, it was called the Hartford Civic Center then. It's now called the XL Center, but it's like our big center where when we used to have our professional hockey team and sports events and concerts and whatnot. So they had a college fair, and I remember there were people handing out Bibles on the steps, and I took one and just started ripping it up in front of them. Like, that's how like much I hated the idea of religion. But for me, it wasn't until I was about 24, so we're going back, you know, what, over 15 years now, that my college professor gave me, and I wish I had, I often joke, some, you know, grand story about how I found my way into the path, but it was really The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, pre-Oprah, thank goodness, because I was still very anti all, you know, the idea of anything, but I trusted my professor, you know, very, very much, and I wasn't much of a reader either, but, you know, I read the introduction to that book, and I knew that my life was never going to be the same. He conveyed it for me in a way that I needed to hear in that moment, and I immediately started. I lived right around the corner from a wonderful library in Middletown, Connecticut, and Autobiography of a Yogi was one of the first books I took out, along with, it was just anything I could get my hands on, from Trungpa Rinpoche to Alan Watts, like you mentioned, Ram Dass, Thich Nhat Hanh, Thomas Merton. It didn't matter, you know, whatever the tradition, it just, as long as it wasn't more of the dogmatic tenets. So I really appreciated how, I think you used the word rational, and that's what it was to me. It was, oh, okay, it's not necessarily churchianity. It's, you know, it's a, there is something, it's a personal experience, as Ram Dass would say, the individual path, and this isn't verbatim, but something to the effect of that the spiritual journey is a highly individualized experience, you know, and it is, and that's been my experience for many years. So I just wanted to, you know, piggyback on what you said and share a bit about my own experience. And with that said, though, you said that there was a nice segue with all of this into the new book. So hopefully I didn't ruin said segue.
No, we're right in sync here.
All right, perfect.
Do you want to? Okay, I'll just go ahead with what I was going to say.
Please.
Part of when going back to what I said about myself, back in, I think it was 1970, early part of 70 or late 69. I just have a vision of where I was living at the time, and I moved so much, I know where I live. Someone gave me a copy of Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi. And I was already embarked on my path. I was already meditating every day and going on retreats, but I hadn't yet read that.
Sure.
But it resonated deeply, and it deepened my path. It deepened my understanding. And it also opened the door to India as a place, you know, in ways that I hadn't had before. And Yogananda's autobiography is so popular even today, 72 years after it was published, and 66 years after he died, one of the reasons for that is very few gurus, swamis, renunciates like he was, write about themselves. They write about knowledge, and maybe they write a little bit about themselves or their guru or their time with their guru.
Sure.
But Yogananda also wrote about growing up in India and all the yogis and these miraculous things he witnessed or heard about. And so there was a taste of a personal quest that you don't usually get. And there was something to identify with and something to sort of increased the fascination with everything I was involved in. And also a lot of insights, you know, into personal, you know, deep spiritual experience and philosophy and so forth. And the book, you know, had a big effect on me. And as I write in the introduction to mine, I never became a student of Yogananda's in a formal way, never became a disciple or a devotee. I had my own path. Right. But he's one of the many, you know, brilliant people who informed me in my path. And that book, I still have all these years later.
Right.
It's a hardcover. It says $5 on the cover. And I know I wouldn't have had $5 to buy a hardcover book in those days. I could barely, you know, scrape together a meal. And sure. So I probably borrowed it and never returned it because I still have it. And with all these moves. And so I always say when asked why I wrote my biography of Yogananda, I always say I'm working out the karma for not returning that book and essentially ripping it off. But that's for humor.
Yes,
the truth is, I was just fascinated. Yogananda was one of the many teachers I respected and admired and learned from. And then about 10, 11 years ago, when I first started researching American Veda, I had to write about all the gurus who ever came here.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, the Westerners who helped propagate the Eastern philosophies and teachings. And so I researched them, and Yogananda, you know, loomed as one of the most important, if not the most important, of the teachers who came here from India. And there are reasons for that. He came in 1920, and he lived here. This America became his home and the international headquarters of the organization he established. And this is where, you know, the bulk of his work was done, which made him famous and which is still influencing people to this day. So he was a major figure in the story I told in American Veda. And so he was one of the few teachers who got a chapter of his own. But and researching that book not only sort of enhanced my respect and admiration for what he accomplished, I became even more fascinated with his human story, the you know, nitty gritty of the life of this yogi and this person with a mission that he was dedicated to, coming to of being a stranger in a strange land in, you know, 1920 and being here through the roaring 20s and the Great Depression and World War II. And what was that like? And what did he encounter? And what obstacles did he have to overcome? And going back further, what was left out of Autobiography of a Yogi about life in India that shaped the person he became? And even more important, what was left out of his autobiography about his life after he came to the West.
Yes, right. And that I love that you did that, you know, because as you mentioned, you know, actually what I wanted to do, if it's right with you, was read a couple of paragraphs just from the introduction, just
please,
to give listeners a little bit more about the book. But I, you know, and I think that'll, because right off the bat, actually, I'll just go ahead and read it because
I'd like to hear it myself.
Yeah, I love that you start the book like this, because I can imagine a lot of people listening, if, you know, I'm sure the majority, if not all of them, are familiar with Yogananda, you know. So, you know, like you say, and let's just jump right into it, in the introduction, and again, I'll just read a few paragraphs, but right off the bat, you start off at the very beginning of the book. The question I was asked most frequently while working on this book was, why do we need a biography of Yogananda when we have Autobiography of a Yogi? The broad answer is this. In the life of any important historical figure, there is room for many books. The specific answers are, and some of this you covered, but again, just to reiterate in your own words from the book, one, Yogananda's iconic memoir is as much about other people as it is about himself. Two, there are major gaps in his narrative, including spans of several years that are summarized in one or two sentences. And three, while Yogananda spent almost all of his adult years in America, less than 10% of the autobiography is about the immensely productive and historically significant period. The prospect of filling in those spaces seemed both enticing and important. Several books have been written about Yogananda by direct disciples. These are valuable first-hand accounts of who he was and what he was like. They are, however, more like tributes than biographies. My goal was to draw a more complete portrait of Yogananda, the human being. An extraordinary human being, to be sure, but human nonetheless, with all the complexity that term implies. The book's central narrative is the saga of a profoundly spiritual being navigating the material realm, attempting to unite fully with the divine while skillfully playing his role in the human drama, just as he taught so many to do themselves. No book can capture the true essence of a soul like Yogananda, but it can describe the footprints he left on the sands of time and space. My goal was to render an accurate, fact-based description of those exceptional footprints. And the final paragraph I wanted to share from this: to many, Yogananda was a saint. To some, he was an avatar, an incarnation of God. I am not qualified to make such evaluations. For me, it was enough that his contribution to spiritual history of East and West is unparalleled, and that his life unfolded in a compelling narrative spanning two hemispheres, two vastly different cultures, two world wars, massive economic upheavals, and unprecedented social changes. I set out to tell that remarkable story as truthfully and thoroughly as I could, knowing full well that I could not do justice to it in 3,000 pages, let alone 300. And not, you know, I'll end there, but you do go on to note, and I really appreciate this, that you say that, you know, and this is me just paraphrasing, but you talk about how you know that you anticipate receiving feedback from both sides, people saying that you're too much of a Yogananda sympathizer, or people saying, you know, that you went too easy or too hard or this or that. And, you know, you can never please everybody. And so what I love is your response to that is
write your own book. That was my attempt to co-opt angry emails.
Headed off at the pass. Well played. Very well played. So I appreciate you giving us, you know, the why and what led you to do this. And I think if anyone is, you know, qualified, you with your history of, you know, your previous books and the work you do and your interfaith wisdom, you know, I'm glad that you were the one to undertake this endeavor. And like you mentioned, there have been other books written about him, but, you know, you did so in as unbiased of a fashion as possible.
And I should add, none of the books about him. There's nobody outside of his circle of disciples have written about him. So
yeah.
I thought there was value in somebody who has, you know, credibility as a professional writer coming at it from the outside.
Right.
And publishing, not in one of the organizations devoted to his work, but from, you know, an independent source.
Yeah, which is so important. And I'm glad you did that. And this, you know, Hay House put it out. They did a tremendous job. It's a beautiful hardback or hardcover, excuse me. And, you know, I love in the middle, there's plenty of lovely pictures you've included, you know, from his talks, all sorts of just wonderful, wonderful material. So, you know, to be fully transparent with the audience, as I mentioned to Phil prior to, generally, I, you know, my conversations, my listeners know, I like to have them as organically as possible, but I typically do prepare some talking points prior to. One of the exceptions is today, where, as I mentioned to Phil, just it's been about 4 or 5 days now or so since I lost one of my very, very dear friends. So, it's been a bit of a difficult few days for me, and I truly have not had the time to devote as much attention to this book as I normally would have prior to speaking with Phil. But I, you know, as we talked about it, and he said, "Well, would you like to reschedule?" And I said, "No, you know, I think this gives us the opportunity to more organically kind of explore this book, which I am in the process of reading." And of course, Actually, Phil, this might work out to your benefit because I know once I'm done, I'll have a million more questions for you. So I'll just have to have you back on the show again. So we'll give you double the exposure.
That'd be fine with me.
Yeah. Yeah. I love talking with you. So with that said, you know, we've still got a good, you know, anywhere from 15, 20, 25 minutes left to go. So let's talk about the book. I mean, as mentioned, you do still give the, you know, a background of him for anyone not really familiar with Yogananda, though, as you mentioned, most people probably, if they've picked this book up, at least know of Yogananda if they haven't already read Autobiography. Yeah. Which
at,
you
at the very least, they've yes. seen his picture in yes. a yoga studio or course. On somebody's altar.
Yes.
Or they've seen the book and they, you know, they've been meaning to read it. At right. the very least, yes. you know, most people will have heard of him. Yeah. Although, you know, it's since the book started to be was in the process of being published and everything, I'd meet people and they say, what are you working on? And I'd tell them. And I was surprised how many people don't know who Yogananda was. So I'm hoping some of them will read it too, just because it's a really good story.
It really is. Yeah. And for me, the type of reader I am, biographies are hit or miss. You know, it has to really, I find, be captivating. And you talk about that too, how in this book you talk about, you know, some of the things that Yogananda's disciples might get upset about because it brings into question, you know, for lack of a better word, it's just the word that's coming to mind is purity or avatar mm-hmm. nature. But, you know, you look at these other teachers like Alan Watts, you know, or Chogyam Trungpa, and, you know, many of them had, you know, their scandals surrounding them or, you know, the alcoholism or this or that. And so I try to appreciate, you know, the saying that listen to the message, not the messenger, to a certain extent. You know,
We should make clear that Yogananda was not, when you mention alcoholism, he's not in that category.
Right.
In fact, there's some very funny anecdotes, you know, because he was, you know, unlike Alan Watts, was not a swami who took right. vows, of, you know, certain right. things. And so it's different. But Yogananda was one of the things that happens when you write a biography is you come across stuff that most people don't know about and yeah. and that show up in, like, if you have access to letters that have never been published or, you know, talks he gave that only a few people have heard and things like that.
Yeah.
But there are wonderful stories and some of them are just fun.
Right.
Some of them are much more meaningful. And yes. and one of the fun things is the one time he had, you know, he had the politeness when he was first in America, tasted beer. Mm. And he apparently dipped his finger in it and tasted it and didn't like it and never did it again. But he right. would do things like when he was at parties, in, you know, being the only swami.
Yes.
When people would, there's one story where he was at a dinner party and the host or whoever it was, waiter, would keep refilling people's wine and he would pour it into his seating companion's glass mm-hmm. and then it would be refilled again. And the other guy got totally drunk because, you know, he didn't want to make a fuss. And so.
Sure, sure.
But apparently he didn't like alcohol.
Yes, no, and that is, and thank you for clarifying, because right, no, he was not like I'd mentioned with Alan Watts or Trungpa Rinpoche and then other scandals, you know. But
but there were accusations, and you know, you're sure. bringing it up, and it's always going to come up.
Of
there
course.
Are, you know, and what's interesting, you know, there was always around every major spiritual figure. There have always been, well, what you could call scandals, but in some cases the scandals were actually, you know, were justified.
They sure.
There was evidence of, you know, improper behavior
right.
or hypocritical behavior, usually around sex or money.
Yes.
And or both. Yeah. And in some cases, the scandals erupt not with insufficient evidence, just by inference or, you know, people have enemies who are disillusioned, disappointed. They'll speculate about things. They'll believe certain things that may or may not have happened,
right,
and will be very vocal about it. And Yogananda was no exception to that.
Yeah.
He endured a lot of that during his lifetime, some of which were like front page news stories.
Sure.
Because they were connected to lawsuits. And, you know, and in those days, I might add, in the 20s and 30s, you know, he was also a dark-skinned heathen from a foreign land teaching, and the majority of his students, as in yoga studios today, were women. And this got a lot of people very upset, not just with him, but with other teachers from India who had come and go. And there was a big to do over these inscrutable Orientals, you know, seducing American women, you know, through their mind power and their hypnotic ability. I mean, this was like, you know, news. There's in one of the photos in the photo section of my book is a 1912 headline from the Washington Post, you know, about with an illustration of a woman bowing at the feet of a Swami, and the headline is "American Women Victims of Hindu Mysticism." So, you know. Plus, you know, he was not only, you know, what people would call a heathen in religious terms, but he was a victim of racism. You know, he was dark skinned. He was Indian, and at a time when Indians weren't even permitted to become citizens. And so he dealt with all this stuff, and he had enemies and people who just didn't like him. And there were all these accusations. But the interesting thing is, he's been dead for 66 years, and people are still to this day arguing over whether he had sex with some of his disciples, whether he fathered children that were kept hidden, and all this sort of stuff. And so I had to address this. There's not many people, you know, he has millions of fans and devotees, and some people, you know, are absolutely convinced he was a reprobate of sorts. And they write about this stuff. And so I had to sift through all the evidence. I wanted to be objective. I had no skin in the game, as they say. I have great respect for Yogananda. But if those accusations had turned out to be true, right, it would not have changed my respect for him as a teacher.
Yeah.
As you know, but it would be very upsetting to other people who hold him, you know, not only in high regard, but as their coveted guru.
Yeah.
Dear guru. And so I wanted to be honest and objective. And truth be told, in the end, as I say in the book, I found no convincing evidence that any of those accusations were true. It doesn't mean they weren't true.
Right.
I just have found no convincing evidence, certainly nothing strong enough for me to take a position and say, you know, he did these things, and history should note it. But, you know, my basic, you know, feeling is he deserves the benefit of the doubt in the absence of convincing evidence.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, anything that happened, if it did happen, happened 70 or 80 years ago or more, 80, 90 years ago. So
yeah, right. Very true. And even with, you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about Maharaji, you know, Ram Dass's guru, and who the whole Love Server member foundation has been based upon his teachings. And a lot of people were unaware that he had a family. He had children.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it's just, we are something. I don't know if you know Jeff Brown, the writer, but he's a really lovely writer. And, you know, he said, and apologies to Jeff if I'm misquoting, but something to the effect of, even though it is absolutely true that we are spiritual beings having a human experience, it is equally true that we are human beings having a human experience. You know, something
that is exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's what that's the attitude I took about Yogananda.
Right.
It was like, as a story,
yeah,
as a human story, as a boy born in 1893 named Mukunda, growing up in India with a certain family at a certain time in certain places, becoming an adolescent, living his formative teenage years and college years in Calcutta, in a part of Calcutta that I compare to Greenwich Village because of its progressive and sort of the revolutionary spirit and the artistic flourishing that was going on there at the time, and the freedom movement and all that, and the abundance of gurus. what did all that, it's, and then coming here.
Yeah.
You know, what is, and then living here and progressing here and having friends here and having students here who are Americans, having to adapt his own way of life, even his appearance.
Right.
And his teaching to American ways and American customs at that time in history, how he did that, how he managed to do it, the obstacles he faced, the burdens he carried, and that is very true. All that makes for and then later in his years, changing certain things about his life and his teachings, writing autobiography, dying at 59, yeah. After illness. And, all that is, to me, a compelling story. But it was one of the really interesting things was part of the human drama, of course, as we all know, is overcoming obstacles right. in our path, suffering from hardship and pain and disappointment, loss, failure, defeat, opposition.
Right.
And all those human things we as spiritual people often think we'd rather not have to deal with, and that we'd rather, or we even assume will disappear from our lives, once we achieve a certain spiritual status.
Right.
But they never disappeared from Yogananda's life. And he was, to his credit, pretty candid about all that he had to deal with. And there were many times when he just said, hey, this is I don't want to do this anymore. I just want to go back to India and live the simple life of a monk.
Yeah.
And he voiced that feeling many times and was drawn to do that, but never did, because, he had this mission. It was given to him by his guru and his guru's guru, and he felt compelled to do it. And, it was like that Al Pacino thing in Godfather 3 where he says, every time I think I'm out, I get dragged
back in. Yeah.
And he felt that. Only in his case, he attributed the pulling back in to God
right.
or to Divine Mother, and all that. And so that, to me, was very compelling, just as on the human level.
Yeah.
And, I wanted to emphasize all that, because I think not only is it a better story, a more compelling narrative, but I think there are lessons in it for all of us who are on a spiritual path and dealing with, real life stuff. Mm-hmm. And, so in certain respects, he's a worthy role model.
Right.
If he went through that crap, why, what makes us think we should be immune to it?
Oh, absolutely. I very much appreciate, how you just relate all of that. Something I could very much relate to in my own way. I mean, not comparing myself to Yogananda, let me be very clear. But yes, the simple or not simple, so simple, but the adversities I faced in my own life, very, having several near-death experiences, et cetera. And then looking at others who, when I was on my own pity pot at certain times, looking at what others have faced or are going through. And yes, maybe I have almost died as a result of the way I chose to live and for several years. But, looking at others and how they overcame adversity, even while in certain situations or circumstances, whether it was on death row or whatever the case may be, that was very inspiring to me, just like the, Yogananda is inspiring to me and others. So it's not that they have to go through that necessarily, but, we all do to a certain extent. So it's,
yep.
It's part of the human experience, and so not to shift gears entirely here, but since we are on the topic, I am curious, and we will come right back to Yogananda, but we're talking about these gurus and teachers from the East coming West and the accusations and whatnot. And I'm curious to see if you have had an opportunity to watch this, this documentary.
Yes, I know where you're going.
So let's hear it. What do you have to say? Well, for the audience, Wild, Wild yeah. Country, it's called, about Osho. And so, yes, I'm only three episodes in. I had heard many of the stories,
but You got a lot of revelations ahead.
Okay, so yeah, what's your take? I mean, what are your
Okay,
thoughts?
this is about Rajneesh, aka Osho, and
Right.
what went down in the intentional community they
Right.
try he and his followers tried to establish in Oregon in the 80s.
Yeah.
Now, I watched it with some friends, and they thought, I, because of American Veda, they knew I had written about all the gurus who had come here, including a section, a few pages about Rajneesh.
Yes.
And I had done my homework enough to write those pages, and so they all thought I would know things. Well, I may have known more than the average person, but that documentary series just blew my mind because I had no idea the depth of the drama and the craziness and that had gone down there. It is really a fabulously told, intricate story. And it shows you on one level the kind of opposition that sort of anything counter to the mainstream can encounter in is sort of infiltrating a traditional small town American way of life. And here are these wild hippies and led by this sort of cult leader figure, to them from India. But it also shows you, what can happen when devotion to a guru can be unhealthy, either because the guru is has his own weaknesses and that you be then become part of, or because you become a true believer and get sucked into an unhealthy culture that surrounds the guru and the people around the gurus. I mean, it's unclear to what extent, and people are arguing about it right now. It's unclear to this extent to which Rajneesh or Osho himself knew about what was going on and the depth of depravity and criminality that was going on among his followers. People will argue about that forever, I'm sure. His defenders will say, oh, he was in silence. This was all the fault of Sheila, the person who, sort of ran the place and was a ringleader. And others will say, of course he knew, and he was nuts himself and he was, evil or whatever, depraved. And we'll never know, but the facts are the facts. And, there were attempted murders and there was, battery of assault rifles and target practice. There was attempted poisoning of people. There was all kind, illegal immigration things going on. It was crazy. And so it's a cautionary tale. The Tibetans have, and I write about this in the biography of Yogananda because, he was a guru and he had close disciples. He himself was a close disciple of, of highly regarded guru, Sri Yukteswar. And he took on that traditional role of disciple with the kind of surrender and devotion that that implies. And he had people around him who did the same to him. And that dynamic, that guru-disciple dynamic, is a very complicated one. And it's not for everybody. It's really for a few people. And but there were also all those around him who were, loyal students, but they were not disciple disciples. And then, there are countless numbers who learn from him, sign up for the courses taught in his name and all that, who never become disciples, but are just students. And around all the gurus of note, there are always these sort of orbits that you can find, at some distance from the center of the guru and the guru's organization. The closest disciples are, close to the nucleus. And then there's other orbits at a greater distance. And everybody has to choose for themselves. But you see it in his story, the importance of that and having a healthy relationship with teachers. And also some of the hazards, and the hazards, you know, are told in that documentary series in spades.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's like the Tibetans have a saying that a guru is like fire. If you don't get close enough, you just don't get warm. Mm. But if you don't get too close, you know, you can get burned.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
So everybody has to find their own distance.
Yeah, very well said. I remember I'd watched the Crazy Wisdom documentary a while back on Trungpa Rinpoche when that came out. And, you know, I was fascinated by that. And, of course, I've read Ram Dass's Paths to God, in which he recounts, you know, many times teaching with Chogyam Trungpa at Naropa and some of the crazy, you know, scenarios that he'd find himself in with Trungpa. But yeah, that pales in comparison to this documentary.
Ram Dass, I should add, since, yeah, you know, you bring him up,
yeah,
you know, his devotion to Neem Karoli Baba, to Maharishi, is, you know, a beautiful example of how transformative in a positive way that relationship can be.
Yes.
But he you know, he had a healthy relationship,
right,
to the guru, and many other people, you know, if it's not a good match,
yeah, yes,
you know, it's not going to work out there. It's like a marriage.
Yeah, exactly. So as we're starting to wind down here, Phil, you know, what I appreciate is that in this biography, you focus quite a bit on the latter part of Yogananda's life in America, which was not really covered at length in his autobiography. So was there, you know, maybe one or two particular things you discovered in your exploration that were, you know, just really stood out to you? Or even if it wasn't the latter part of his years, anything in general while you were researching and working on this book that really was a big, I don't know, for lack of a better word, epiphany, or just a, you know, a wow,
yeah,
moment for you?
There were a lot of small epiphanies.
Sure. Okay.
Oh, I didn't know that. No one knows that. Oh,
yeah.
I get to write about this. It's nowhere else.
Yeah.
And, you know, the big one we have already talked about, which was the degree to which he had obstacles in his way, and the degree to which there were upheavals and challenges that he had to overcome. And a lot of that had to do with money. You know,
right,
he early in his life, you know, when he was training with his guru, he called organizations hornet's nests.
Mm.
And he really didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, he had this mission to bring, you know, his lineage's teachings to the West, and he was going to fulfill that. And so you get enough students and you get enough people coming to hear you speak. And, you know, and he was filling auditoriums. He filled,
sure,
Carnegie Hall. He filled, you know, 3,000 seat auditoriums. And when you get that kind of success, you get those kind of numbers, and you have a mission, well, it requires organization, and organizations require money.
Yeah.
And in his case, properties were bought, and, you know, and then the depression hit. Well, he was worried about money and struggling for money to cover the bills and everything his whole time in America, right up. You see it in his letters just weeks or months before he died. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was still worried about the future of the organization, as it would, you know, the health that would it survive his death, and what steps could he take? So he had to deal with all this stuff like a CEO or an entrepreneur does, when he would much rather have just been meditating in a cave.
Yeah.
But he never stopped meditating.
Right.
He never stopped his sadhana. He never gave that up. That was always the priority, but he still had to do all this stuff. And the degree of challenge that presented to him was a surprise to me, and I think will come as a surprise even to many of his disciples. And then there were little things like, you know, he was here during the Indian freedom movement, you know, and so I one of the things I like doing is placing incidents in the context of history as it was being made at that time. So what was going on in India? What was going on in World War II? What was going on with the Great Depression as certain periods of Yogananda's life? And one thing he never hid was his fondness for Gandhi and his advocacy of Indian independence. Yeah. That could have, he was traveling here on a British passport because he was a British subject of, you know, Imperial India, of, you know, the British colonial power. And he could have been deported at any moment as a subversive. And the Brits were keeping an eye on him. Right. And I had access to certain documents that show, you know, they were even opening his mail. They were, you know, spying on him and then going to see, hear him speak and then sending in reports. Do you think this guy's a subversive? You know, is he okay? Can we let him stay? All this stuff was going on, and, you know, people don't know about that. And I don't even know if he knew about it at the time.
Sure.
But he certainly knew that he was under scrutiny. And, you know, the other thing was that was interesting was the degree to which he commented on current affairs and politics and world, you know, what was going on in the world. He was a renunciate, but he was engaged. And I found that admirable and also a bit surprising.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I want to ask you one last question before we wrap this up. And I, as I mentioned, love Yogananda's work. I also really appreciated his book, Whispers from Eternity. A lot of beautiful wording in there. Mm. And, you know, he was just a gifted writer. I actually, even before you and I spoke, I had begun my endeavoring back into his like 1,000-plus page, The Second Coming of Christ, you know, is a wonderful read. But so you start your book out with a quote, which is a beautiful quote of his, and amongst the many, where he says, "We are here today, tomorrow we are gone, mere shadows in a cosmic dream. But behind the unreality of these fleeting pictures is the immortal reality of spirit." And so I just wanted to close by asking you why that particular quote to begin this book.
This is very funny, Chris. I was thinking, I finished the book. It was being edited. I was rewriting, and I was thinking, I'd love to have an epigraph, and a good epigraph, and it should be something from him.
Yeah.
Not something, you know, by some other philosopher or something.
Sure.
And I was thinking, you know, I got thousands and thousands of pages of his writing. I couldn't go through all that, and I had various quotes on file that I either used in the book or didn't, and I didn't find anything suitable. But SRF, Self-Realization Fellowship, comes out with a Yogananda calendar every year with beautiful, beautiful nature pictures on each of, you know, one page for each week in the year, beautiful pictures and a quote from Yogananda. So I had one, and it was a few years old, and I looked through it, and bingo. There it was, right there, and the reason, and I said, okay, this is the quote, because A, it tells you about the sort of metaphysical reality that his work, like all the gurus, embodies, you know, that we are here, and we are just, you know, flitting images on a screen, the light projecting is pure spirit and eternal and infinite.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's who we are. That is the nature of this human manifestation. But our true nature is, you know, pure spirit, Brahman, as they say in India. But the other part is that we are here today, tomorrow we are gone. Well, that reflects a life story in one little passage. And I was writing a life story. I was writing a biography. Mm-hmm. So it resonated on that level of both, you know, what the book attempts to show, which is, you know, as you read, the footprint of somebody who was here today and gone tomorrow, and also the bigger reality.
Yeah. Well, wonderfully said. Thanks for sharing that story, Phil, and everything else. The book, again, it's called The Life of Yogananda, The Story of the Yogi Who Became the First Modern Guru, by Phil Goldberg, or Philip, professionally speaking, Goldberg, who is also the author of American Veda, another wonderful book. And again, I highly encourage anyone listening to check out his website, philipgoldberg.com. If, again, you're on the Be Here Now Network site, just scroll down. There will be a link attached. Just click on that. And Phil, you mentioned earlier, I believe you have a workshop coming up with our friend Dana Sawyer at Kripalu.
Yeah, I have a lot of things coming up.
Yeah, tell us about that.
My calendar on my website.
Okay.
I'm going to be going around many cities speaking about the book and other things. So I invite people to come up and introduce themselves as fellow mutual fans of Chris Grasso. And but also, yeah, the one at Kripalu is in early June, and it's a 4-day meditation retreat at Kripalu. You know, Dana's a great scholar of Indian philosophy
and
mantra, and it's built around mantra meditation and the use of mantra. And I invite everybody to check that out on the Kripalu site and come see us. And you can hear interviews with wonderful people like Chris Grasso on spiritmatters.com, although yours hasn't been posted as of this recording. And you can even join me on a tour of India in the fall. All this on my website, but enough commercials.
Yes, no, but it is. I mean, I'm horrible with self-promotion. It feels icky to me. I'm still working on it, but it's, you know, we've got to do what we've got to do to continue getting the work out and the word out. And when it's coming from a place of passion and integrity, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. So,
and again, we can be inspired by Yogananda, who early on when he was here, the first few years, which he spent in Boston, had to be convinced to advertise.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So thank God I have a publisher to at least do that end of things for me. But
yeah.
Anyways, Phil, it's been a real pleasure. Like I said, I will definitely have you back on again once I'm able to complete the book, and we can go even more in depth into you know, all of the stories and much of what I'm guessing many of our listeners don't know about Yogananda, but at that time maybe they will, since they will have had a chance to read the book themselves. So
they can send their emails to me and we can, you know, answer questions.
Oh, that's a great idea. Cool. Yeah, Ken Wilber and I did that for a series on Integral Life.
Oh, great.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun doing that. So maybe we'll do something like that here too. Great idea.
Okay.
All right, Phil. Thank you. I appreciate it. And have yourself a lovely day.
You too.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.